We're going to continue this week, hopefully get through chapter 3. And you'll remember with me that the book of Hosea is, at least in our canon, the first of the minor prophets, and probably the third chronologically. He's one of the prophets to the northern kingdom of Israel during a time of prosperity that is quickly coming to an end, and during a time of spiritual adultery where Israel has played the harlot in their relationship with God. And so God calls Hosea to visibly demonstrate that in his prophecies by taking a wife of harlotry and children of harlotry, because the land has committed great harlotry by departing from the Lord. So we looked last week at the first of his three children. And each of his children's names, the three, have great significance in the prophecies. In fact, they sort of function as the prophecies. The first one we saw last week was his firstborn son, Jezreel, in verses 3 through 5. And Jezreel was named after a valley and a city inside of that valley, where there had been much bloodshed over Israel's history, particularly when Jehu went and he killed Ahab's family. And took the throne afterwards, which he did by the word of the Lord. But it was a very bloody place. And what Hosea says to Jehu's grandson, Jeroboam II, is that the same sort of bloodshed is going to visit Jeroboam's house, and he's going to bring an end of the kingdom of Israel, the northern kingdom, which had been very wicked. So that was the name of Hosea's first son, Jezreel. Let's move on. That'll bring us to verse 6 and look at the second two children, the second child and then the third child. So verse 6, and she, which is Hosea's wife Gomer, conceived again and bore a daughter. Then God said to him, call her name Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no longer have mercy on the house of Israel, but I will utterly take them away. Yet I will have mercy on the house of Judah, will save them by the Lord their God, and will not save them by the bow, nor by sword, nor battle, by horses or horsemen. So about the same length attributed to the second child, this one a daughter. And so he names his daughter No Mercy, or No Love, or No Compassion, would all be appropriate ways of thinking of that. So Lo-Ruhamah is simply a transliteration, right? It's our English characters that are one-to-one, essentially, with the Hebrew characters. I think it might have a little bit more punch if we just translated it in English, because it all comes through the same way then, right? All the other words are translated mercy as we go throughout the text. So it kind of makes sense to translate the name that way, too. I guess, portrays the dramatization to us in English, too. If I were to name my daughter, Caden, essentially, I don't love you. And that's what I call her. Hey, come here, I don't love you. And when I do that, it sort of creates a scene every time I say her name, doesn't it? Everyone turns and looks and wonders, why have I done that? And that begins the prophecy, is essentially every time he speaks his daughter's name. I mean, imagine naming your daughter that. I'll have no more mercy on you, no more compassion on you. And so what may play out here is that as people hear this name, they sort of begin to talk amongst themselves. And they're like, did you hear her name? You know, and we know who his wife is. She's unfaithful. And is it that he's now rejected his child because of his wife's unfaithfulness? And Hosea could respond to these rumors by saying, ah, do you trouble yourselves over my daughter, No Mercy? Well, you are No Mercy. That is you. And your father has given you no more mercy. So it really is, it's a dramatization for the effect of the prophecy. That's what he's getting at. Supposed to sort of have a shock effect. And that's similar to, if you remember back with Nathan, when he came to David and he tells a story, right? He tells a story and paints the man in a bad light. And David is out to get that man. He says, who is it? When he points the finger right back at David and says, you are that man. That's kind of a similar thing to what Hosea is doing here, is garnering some sympathy for this one. And then he says, nah, you are this, you are my child. So the name specifically is intended to kind of expose the estrangement that's taken place between Israel and God, because she, his daughter, Israel's daughters, has gone after Baal, and the long suffering of God is growing short. So there's a little bit of difficulty with the last phrase of verse 6, but I will utterly take them away in the New King James. Does anyone else have a very different reading of the last line? To forgive them all. Well, that's very different, isn't it? Oh, he will not forgive them at all. Okay. So he will no longer have mercy and no longer forgive them. Okay. So there's one of the other main readings. And that's quite different, though it's still negative, right? I'm going to take them away, sort of a exile language, or I won't forgive them. So what's interesting is that the language seems to, it's most naturally read in a positive light. That he will nasa them. And nasa is a word that kind of the root meaning would be to lift, like to lift something up. And a lot of times forgiveness is the idea that he's going to forgive. But because of the difficulty there, when it seems like he's saying, I will not have mercy, I'm no longer going to have mercy. And then why would he say, but I will forgive them? seems so opposite to the prophecy. So people generally tend to run away from that and say, okay, well, what else would Nasa mean? Or is it that they missed the negative? You know, I'm not going to forgive them, that sort of thing. Because it stands in such stark contrast to the previous words of condemnation. But that reading, actually think that it makes, if you look at the broader context and some of the other things that are happening, some of the other very sharp contrasts that he makes, I think that natural reading is probably to be preferred. So if you read it, verse 6, call her name, no mercy, for I will no longer have mercy on the house of Israel, but I will forgive them. It is sharp, but there are other very sharp ones incoming. So in verses 9 and 10, we have, call his name not my people. But then in verse 10, yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sands of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. That's a very sharp contrast. Or in verse 10 itself, in the place where it was said to them, you're not my people, there it shall be said to them, you are sons of the living God. So there's a very sharp contrast of something that seems against and then something that seems for. Or we're about to read in chapter 2 of, it's kind of like a divorce oracle where, you know, she's not my wife, nor am I her husband. And then by the end of it, there's an eternal covenant that's made and the marriage vows are renewed. So it seems that that these sort of sharp contrasts are pretty natural to the way that Hosea is reading. And if we read it negatively, then we have Israel condemned in verse 6, but Judah restored in verse 7. So a very distinct contrast between Israel and Judah. But later in the text of Hosea, another thing that he seeks to do is he seeks to bring back Israel and Judah into one house, seeking one king, David. So to say, you I will put off, never remember, you'll always be forgotten, I won't forgive you, but I'll restore Judah, doesn't seem to flow with the thought that, hey, this never should have been two, and God's going to make it one again. So for those reasons, I think it probably is preferred to take the reading, I will no longer have mercy on the house of Israel, but I will forgive them. Yes, I will have mercy on the house of Judah. I will save them by the Lord their God, and I will not save them by the bow, nor by sword or battle, by horses or horsemen. So he does promise salvation to, I believe, Israel and Judah together. That'll be more explicit later on. But it's not really the military expansion that they're looking for. Perhaps even very similar to the category of Jews that were waiting for the Messiah to come deliver them from Rome. He's saying, that's not really what I'm coming to do. That's not the nature of my salvation, even to you I'm promising in the Old Testament. And he says, it's not going to be by the bow, by the sword, by the battle, by horses, or by horsemen. I think this is giving us not explicitly stated, but is giving us a glimpse at, rather than the military deliverance, that it's a spiritual deliverance. That sort of like Zechariah would say, not by might or by power, but by the Spirit, but by my Spirit. So there's, an allusion here to the nature of their eventual salvation. In the second child, his daughter, no mercy. So that takes us to the third child, which is a second son. And there seems to be a few years break between the two, because they don't have the third child until after Lo Ruhamah, no mercy, is weaned, which would have been a few years old at this time. So then God says, for the third child, call his name Lo Ami, which is again a transliteration, which means not my people. It says, because you are not my people, and I will not be your God. So imagine once again a father who names his son essentially not my son. So his daughter, I won't love you, I won't have mercy on you. His son, you're not my son, you're not my person, you're not of me. So these are, and this one's quite short, isn't it? Just verses 8 and 9. There's not much of a further description, lest we include 10 through 12, or 10 through 11, and then verse 1 of chapter 2 in the description. One of the things that Hosea is doing pretty frequently throughout here is he's saying something very dark and dramatic, and then he reverses it almost immediately. So Valley of Jezreel is a very dark and a very bloody place. He says, this is where this is going to happen to you. And then very soon, he's going to say, actually, it's going to be a place of great blessing. I'm going to reverse the meaning of Jezreel for you. And then he says, no mercy, no mercy, but I will forgive. And he says, not my people, not my people, but verse 10, yet the number of the children of Israel will be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. And it shall come to pass in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people. There it shall be said to them, you are sons of the living God. So you're not mine, and I am not yours. Our family has been severed. And then immediately, reversal promised. So it's almost like this father kind of kicking his son out of the house, right? Like disowning him. You're not my son. Get out. But know that there's going to be a day when your family will return and we'll have a big reunion. It's kind of odd how dramatic the two images are back to back. And in verse 10, we see pretty clearly that takes us back to the Abrahamic covenant, doesn't it? That he's going to make his children very abundant, sands of the sea. It sounds very similar, if not the exact same words, as what God said to Abraham. So I'll ask this question. At the end of 10, it moves from, so the very same area that it was said to you, not my people, there it said, sons of the living God. That phrase, the movement from not people to sons of the living God, what's significant about being sons of the living God? Yeah, that's absolutely it. So the first one is obvious and distinct because of the nature of what's happening here. This is Hosea's children, right? And his third son, or his third child, is named basically not my son, not my kid. And so to be moved from that into sonship language, once again, that's significant. That's one of the reinstatement of familial bonds, basically. And that's a beautiful thing. And then how about the second half? What is the significance of being related, particularly perhaps in Hosea's time, and keeping in mind Hosea's prophecy, to the living God. Okay, so movement to the Gentile nations is a thought. I don't know that it's the intent right now is to go beyond national bounds, but thinking about what's happening inside national boundaries. Like, what is Israel doing during the time of this prophecy? What gods are they chasing? All the dead ones, right? They love the Baals. That's who they're pursuing. And so then to be called a son of the living God would be clear. And Isaiah does speak about that too, doesn't it? Like he describes how they have eyes, but they can't see and all of these sorts of things that they're dead. And so that's this, I think the two primary things going on in that line is like, one, you have the familiar relationship and reinstated, but with who is quite important, that it is reinstated with the God who is alive, in contrast to all the gods they've been in relationship with that are dead. So then verse 11, we have the reunion again of Judah and Israel. Children of Judah, children of Israel shall be gathered together and appoint for themselves one head, for they shall come up out of the land, for great will be the day of Jezreel. So Hosea then prophesies the reunification of the nation under one appointed leader. So he's communicating the fracturing of all of Joseph's sons, right? All of these tribes, that was never intended. So here God promises to restore that which is broken, to reset the bone, bringing them all together once again under the intended promised ruler, which we've learned only a few generations before, is the Davidic ruler, the one who's supposed to sit on the throne of David. So then this phrase that When this occurs, then they're going to come up out of the land. That could be one of two things. Either coming up out of the land is coming up out of exile, coming up out of the oppression, or, and probably to be favored because of the use of land, if they're coming out of the land, that is, they were taken out of the land in exile. So to be coming up from the land is probably more a metaphor of this fruitfulness, that they were going to abound. And if you remember last week, the specific definition of Jezreel is that God sows. So in this bloody valley, which technically means God sows, like God's going to reverse the meaning back to its original intent, that though it wasn't intended to be a place where blood was shed time after time after time, he's now going to say, great is the day of Jezreel. You're actually going to be fruitful once again, because I'm going to plant you in the land and you will come up out of it like a fruitful harvest. So that mention of Jezreel should bring us right back to the first child. And then in the following two verses, which probably are better placed with chapter 1 than they are beginning a new section in chapter 2, he uses all three of the children's name within a verse, bringing us to the conclusion of the naming and the impact of the prophecy of the children. So he says, for great will be the day of Jezreel. Say to your brothers, my people, that was the name of the brother, and say to your sisters, mercy is shown. So the names of the children are all reversed from a bloody valley to a valley of fruitful sowing, from not being his people to being his people, from not being shown mercy to being shown mercy. So that's kind of the end of that first section. And it begins beyond that. In chapter 2, all of chapter 2 together, is a description of like this divorce proceedings. So we have at the beginning this call for the children to forsake their mother's activities, even for the mother herself to forsake her activities, or they're going to lose everything. And then he brings some accusations before her, and he describes that he himself has already abandoned her. And then there's a series of judgments from verse 6 through verse 13. Now, the interesting thing is that at the end of the divorce proceedings, you would expect it to just be over. You maybe would have these judgments that are laid out, and then it's done. But at the very end of it, there's sort of this surprise ending in the second half of chapter 2 that ends the divorce with a remarriage. And so we'll see that as we go through. Let's read the first half of chapter 2. Bring charges against your mother, bring charges, for she is not my wife, nor am I her husband. Let her put away her harlotries from her sight and her adulteries from between her breasts, lest I strip her naked and expose her as in the day she was born, and make her like a wilderness and set her like a dry land and slay her with thirst. I will not have mercy on her children, for they are children of harlotry. For their mother has played the harlot. She who conceived them has behaved shamefully. For she said, I will go after my lovers who give me my bread and my water, my wool and my linen, my oil and my drink. We'll actually pause there. We'll just walk through that. And then the judgments begin in verse 6 through and finish up in 13. So initially, the statement is to his children. And here's where in chapter 2, particularly, we move quite quickly from, I think chapter 1's an emphasis on Hosea. Like we have quite clearly, go marry this woman, and these are his three children and the names of the children. And there's absolute application to Israel. There's no confusion there. But the emphasis seems to be on Hosea and his wife. In chapter 2, it sort of switches, and it's still about Hosea and his wife and this divorce sort of idea that there's this separation and he's calling to his children, but the emphasis shifts quite strongly to Israel. So the language in chapter 1 is more about Hosea. The language in chapter 2 is more about the people. So when he says bring charges, Hosea, it's talking about to his children while they're still quite young. And this bring charges is telling them to find fault with their mother, to observe who she is, to identify her as a woman of harlotry, and to denounce her because she's a great sinner. So the statement of divorce from the father, and then he's like encouraging the children to kind of follow suit and divorce their mother. So we're just take that into the Israelite setting. We might say, children of the covenant, find fault with Israel, find fault with your mother. Set yourself apart from her and her sinful ways. Denounce your culture. Denounce this chasing of the Baals as apostate. God himself has set Israel aside because of her great sin, and you should do the same. So he's really calling people to be separate from the sinfulness of the nation. And then he calls to his wife as well in the second half of verse 2. So Gomer, right? Put away your harlotries. Stop running after other lovers. Be faithful to your marriage vows. He uses these parallel lines. Put away the harlotries from your sight. Put away the adulteries from between her breasts. So that sight is actually the word for face. So her face is probably describing more like her intent or her personality, these things that she's doing, her desires in her adulteries. And then between her breasts is probably just this metonymy of the body with an emphasis on the sexual things that she's doing, right? So he's saying, abandon all of that. Turn your whole person away from this promiscuous behavior. Abandon it all. So turning that to the encouragement to Israel, we might say Israel, or perhaps even the leadership of Israel as the mother, lead the people toward holy worship. Stop running toward the Baals. Stop willingly joining pagan worship. Be faithful to your covenant and to the God who has faithfully established you and protected you and blessed you. Or he'll take everything from you. He's going to take everything from Gomer. Leave her vulnerable. There's these metaphors of nakedness and this drought-afflicted land. She's going to be exposed as in the day that she was born. That's the first metaphor. And the second one is the dry land, just like no water, eventually to the point that she dies from a lack of water. She dies from thirst. Now, we'll see this again displayed more clearly, but what God's doing is simply taking away the things that he had already given and that she is attributing to having received from Baal. So he says, that's not from him, it's from me, and I come and take, I claim my right on that which is mine. And she's left exposed, vulnerable, with nothing. That could be, this is probably supposed to point us toward Israel's, yes, unrepentance that leads toward their exile, where they are brought to nothing, led away in chains. They have no land. And their land is left in a drought. So then he moves on in verse 4 and 5. I'm not going to have mercy on her children because they're children of harlotry. There we get, again, we have the emphasis of lo ami, not my people, not my child. So eventually they're going to be said sons of the living God. But right now they're said to be sons of a harlot. And the reason for that, as we sort of talked about last night, I don't think is because they're children of another man, but because of the character of Israel, because of who they are, what they've been born into. And that's what verse 5 is describing, because the character of their mother is prostitute. She who conceived them, she's behaved shamefully. And here's this accusation that's led toward the severing of this marriage vow. She said, I'm going to go another way. I'm abandoning the covenant. I'm pursuing instead this lack of covenant with other people, and they will provide for me instead of you. I choose no husband that provides rather than this husband that provides. He who gives me bread and water, wool and linen, oil and drink, those three pairs, and those will come up two or three more times throughout. If you take bread and water, that's like your food, right? Your wool and linen is like your clothing, and your oil and drink are a whole host of other things, but could be more like festival or worship oriented. So all of these various categories, she says, I'm abandoning Yahweh's provision and choosing instead the provision of Baal. And so the response of God is quite severe, a series of judgments. They start with, therefore, behold, I will this, I will that. You see it in verse 6, you see it again in verse 9 and following. So 6 through 8 is kind of our next piece. And the first thing that he promises to do in his judgment is that he's going to put a wall around her. He's going to hedge her way with thorns, wall her in so that she cannot find her paths. Now why? What's the significance of her paths? Well, her paths are taking her to all of these other lovers. Her paths are taking her away from the home, away from the covenant. So he says, I'm going to put you in a box, basically. And every time you try and go out, I'm going to foil your plans. You might imagine, perhaps if we thought modernly, like this is someone who is trying to go and break their covenant vows, but perhaps the person they were looking for is not home, or perhaps they go and try to send a meeting spot, but the address got mixed up, and so they go to two different places, or maybe their phone dies and they're not able to communicate, or maybe somebody gets sick and you can't. It's like every time it's just foiled, it's messed up, it won't work. And that's supposed to cause Gomer and Israel to then consider, well, maybe my relationship with Israel, or my relationship with Hosea and with Yahweh, with God, is better. Maybe I shouldn't be doing this because the plans continue to get foiled. And that's what happens at the end of verse 7. So even though she's chasing her lovers, she can't find them. Even though she's seeking them, she won't find them. So then she considers and she says, okay, well then maybe I will go and I'll return to my first husband because that was better than this. It took her not receiving the fruits of her adultery to realize that her relationship with her husband was better. 8 sort of finishes off this section and exposes another thing. It's kind of another accusation, actually, because Gomer and Israel have attributed all of this stuff, her grain, her new wine, her oil, the multiplication of her silver and gold, to her false god. She says, that's where my sustenance comes from. That's who ultimately provides for me. And all of this stuff comes from Baal worship, right? They're preparing it for him. They believe that he's the one that provides fertility, and they believe that he's the one that provides abundant harvest and all these things. And so God says his second judgment is that he's going to return. Why don't I revisit her and remind her that all of those things have not come from Baal? They've come from me. I'm her provider. I'm her covenant companion. So I'm going to come and I'll take away the grain in its time. I'll take away my new wine in its season. I'll take back my wool and my linen given to cover her nakedness. And what that results in is this situation where he comes and takes everything from her, including even the very clothes on her back, and exposes her in front of her lovers in verse 10. And no one is able to help her. Completely isolated, exposed because of what she's done in the covenant. So all the things that she's trusted from these other lovers, the provision of food, the provision of clothing, the provision of festivities, the provision of a vineyard and new wine, all of those things initially stated in verse 5, reiterated in verse 8, God says he's the giver of them in verse 9, and he just goes through this and says, all of it, I'm going to take away. And remind you, like, this is not yours. This is something that came from my hand. This is my goodness to you. And he leaves her exposed, including in verse 11, I cause all her mirth to cease. This is revolving around all of the festivities, even the religious festivals that they have somewhat kept. You remember Jeroboam II, he sort of recreated his own worship services. He kept some of the things from Yahweh, and he also made up things himself, and then he brought in some things from the ancient Near East, and he just blended it all together to be Israel's new worship system. He says all of that has to go. It needs to be purified. Including verse 12, the destruction of, there's the oil and drink, destroy her vines and her fig trees, of which she said, these are my wages that my lovers have given me. And he makes them instead to be overgrown, to go back to the forest. And then all of the beasts of the field are able to have their way with it. It just goes back to being unkept, no longer cultivated. And it's a punishment, verse 13 explicitly describes, for all of the time that she has given to another lover. All of the time that she has given to the Baals, where she went and worshiped, went and adorned herself for him. She went to her other lovers and forgot Yahweh. So all of this, it's a sad tale if you think about it from a covenant perspective. It's a tale of a wrecked marriage. It's a tale of unfaithfulness, a tale of brokenness, and frustration. And that's where it, from a human perspective, normally would end, right? It's over. It's so dead. It's so gone. You've abandoned it. You've forgotten me. And so I forget you. I take back all my stuff. You want to go do that? Okay, go do that. But not with me. And so you think that that is where it would end. But there's one final thing that God says that he's going to do. It's parallel with verse 6 and verse 9, right? Therefore, I will hedge up your ways. Therefore, I will return and take away everything. And he says in verse 14, therefore, behold, I will allure her. Meaning he's going to woo her. He's going to bring her into the wilderness, which seems like an odd place to go and woo someone. But sometimes, not only is the wilderness throughout the Old Testament described as a place of desolation and drought, even like before in chapter 2, but it's also a place of reconstruction. It's a place where it's the beginning of new things. Perhaps when you're brought to nothing, you realize what you need, right? You realize after he hedges her in and makes it so she can't find her lovers, he brings her to the wilderness there to woo her. And she says, okay, I will return. I will go back. It is better with my husband. And he speaks comforting words to her. And then immediately he begins to reinstate the very things that he had taken previously. He says, I will give her vineyards from there and the valley of Achor as a door of hope. She shall sing there as in the days of her youth, as in the day when she came up from the land of Egypt. So this, beginning in 14 through the end of the chapter, we have some neat structure. I should have put this part up on the screen. It would have been easier to see, but I'll at least describe it and you can look through it as we go. But 14 and 15 would be our A in the structure. And that's a reversal. So he's gone from taking her, rejecting her, these divorce images, to wooing her once again. That's 14 and 15. And then the B is a new marriage. And that's verses 16 and 17. In that day, you'll call me husband, no longer master. And then we have C, which is the reinstatement of a beautiful place. It's like an Edenic paradise in verse 18. I'm going to make a covenant for them. And he describes a beautiful place. So we have A, B, C, the reversal, the new marriage, and then Eden. So he begins stepping back out of that to B prime, which is the new marriage. Right? That's verses 19 and 20. He describes their betrothal once again, a new marriage, verses 19 and 20. 21 and 22 is our C prime. That's the new Eden described again. It'll come to pass. It'll answer, and it has to do with the heavens and the earth, and there's this fruitfulness and abundance. And then finally, at the end of, in verse 23, we have A prime, which is a grand reversal again, not of the wooing, not the marriage relationship, but the children. There's a reversal of the children again. And there's the mercy and the my people are restated. So that's kind of how the rest of the chapter goes. If we look in the first one, and we look at the Valley of Achor as a door of hope, the Valley of Achor points us back to the very beginning of the conquest when Joshua is leading the people into the land. And after they blow the trumpets and they shout and Jericho falls, well, they were commanded not to take anything from it, right? They burned it and left it. But what happened? Well, there was Achan, right? And he took some things. He took some plunder. He took some spoils. And God's wrath came upon them. And then they ended up losing an Ai, and they discovered, you know, Achan's faults and his sins, and he was killed. Right? Achan was taken, his life was taken. And his grave was then marked with this pile of rocks, and the location was named the Valley of Achor, which is to say the Valley of Trouble, because they experienced great trouble there. So what was Achan's sin? Well, it was seizing riches. It was taking from the bales, wasn't it? And what's Gomer's sin? Well, seizing the gifts of her lovers, taking from the bales. So what happens here is the grace of God reverses the meaning of Achor. Instead of implying punishment for the deed, it's become a place of restoration and wholeness, this wilderness place where God woos Israel once again. Instead of the Valley of Trouble, it's a door of hope. And it leads to her rejoicing, right? She's going to sing as when she was young. She's going to sing as when she was just like those first days of dating, right? Back to the chills that you got and the butterflies that you got in your stomach and that sort of thing. It's going to take you back to that point in your relationship. All of this bitterness and frustration and even brokenness of the marriage forgotten. And it's going to be like back in the great days, like the days when she came out of Egypt in the beginning of the covenant, when the marriage was established there at Sinai. So that's the reversal. Is he going to woo her once again? And then 16 and 17, the new marriage. There's going to be a day, that day, the day of Jezreel, right, when bitterness is turned to sowing. You'll call me husband, and it will no longer be master. It'll no longer be this bitterness between us. And I'm going to take from your mouth the name of the Baals. And not just from your mouth, from your mind. They'll be remembered no more. We won't speak of it again. We won't speak of all this infidelity. We're not going to bring that up. It'll be taken away. And not only will our marriage be renewed, but in that same day, the place is going to be renewed. The land is going to be renewed. The animals are going to be renewed. And he brings up this language that's very similar to Genesis 1 and very similar to the language of even the covenant that we looked at last week with Noah. And that day, I'll make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field, who previously, the beasts of the field, were ravaging their abandoned vineyard. And now there's a covenant that's made with the beasts of the field, with the birds of the air, and with the creeping things of the ground. There's our Genesis language. And here's another significant one, isn't it? Look, think back on last week. Bow and sword of battle I will shatter from the earth to make them lie down safely. So we have the covenantal language renewed once again as a prophecy, right? It started bright, descended into great darkness, but it will return again to even bigger and better and brighter than ever before. And there it will be, so, you know, the war and wars, that sort of an idea. Everything's all that's going to be shattered. These militaries are going to be shattered, and we're going to have peace. We're going to have sleep. We're going to have safety. It's going to be a beautiful place for a beautiful marriage to flourish. And then it gets even more descriptive of both of those last two. So the marriage described, this is one of the most stunning two verses, I think, in the Old Testament. I will betroth you to me forever. This brokenness won't happen again. Right? We won't be able to have other lovers involved. That's gone. I'll betroth you to me forever. I'll betroth you to me in righteousness and justice. That beautiful pair. In loving kindness and mercy. Another beautiful pair. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord. He reverses the declaration of no marriage, and he creates an eternal one, founded in God's characteristics of righteousness, justice, chesed, loving kindness, and mercy, and then faithfulness. The fact that you can trust it, the fact that it will endure, the fact that it will be unending. And then that last statement, you shall know the Lord, undoes the fact of the end of verse 13. She had gone after other lovers and forgotten the Lord. But now in the renewal of the vows, she will know him. She will remember him. The names of all those old gods have faded from her mind, and the name of Yahweh is brought to preeminence once again. Then he describes lastly the Eden again, a little bit more vivid pictures. The first one emphasized the animals, and the second one emphasizes the ground. So it's going to come to pass in that day that I will answer, says the Lord. He's going to answer the heavens, and they shall answer the earth. The earth shall answer with grain, new wine, with oil. They shall answer Jezreel. Then I will sow her for myself in the earth. So in this place, he moves the last little bit, begins connecting it to the final piece of the reversal of the names of the children with Jezreel. But in this place called I will sow, all of the earth is going to be brought into abundance. I'm going to plant my people there, and they will grow abundantly for himself on this new earth. So the names are all undone after that. Jezreel, I will have mercy then on her who had not obtained mercy. So now, Ruhama instead of Lo Ruhama. And then Ami instead of Lo Ami. And then the people respond, and you are our God, which is previously in verse 8 of chapter 1. You shall call his name Lo Ami, for you are not my people, and I will not be your God. And so now there's just this return, this restoration, this wholeness, this fullness. This is a prophecy of what's going to happen, perhaps in seed form or beginning in the millennial kingdom. We see pieces of that, but ultimately is fulfilled in new earth, in new heaven. When the curse is undone, when everything is brought to fulfillment, when the people no longer have, there is no other God in their minds, right? That all of that oldness has faded, as Isaiah says. It's going to be a beautiful thing. That's the end of the divorce. The end of the divorce is wholeness, is a beautiful, it's restoration. So in chapter 3, the last little bit here we'll look at, just briefly, it comes back to Hosea and to his relationship with Gomer and what he's supposed to do in history. So the Lord said to Hosea, go again, love a woman who is loved by a lover and is committing adultery, just like the love of the Lord for the children of Israel. who look to other gods and love the raisin cakes of the pagans. So it's kind of in the in-between. There's like a break between verses 13 and 14 of Hosea chapter 2. And what happens between the brokenness of the marriage vow and the restoration? Well, this is kind of what happens. Hosea goes and he brings back Gomer, and God's going to go and he's bringing back Israel. But there's this in-between time where the marriage isn't very blessed. It's not very fruitful. It's not very productive. He says, so I bought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver and 1.5 homers of barley. And I said to her, you shall stay with me. Like, remain. You're in my house. And you can't play the harlot. You don't go out, nor shall you have a man. And the same thing is going to be true of me. You don't exactly have me either. For the children of Israel, here's the pair, for the children of Israel will abide many days without king or without prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, without ephod or teraphim. But afterward, the children of Israel shall return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and they shall fear the Lord and his goodness in the latter days. So in the in-between, before they return and seek the Lord, before Gomer says, I will go and return to my first husband, still in this, like, they're being, like, punished, but they're also, they're being, like, brought near and, like, just sit here, just stay. Don't move. We're not, like, reconciled exactly, but you're also not just going down this path. You can't continue going out of these paths. You're going to keep chasing other lovers. And so that's sort of what Hosea does, is he purchases his wife. He says, I'll pay, not just for a night, but for a long period of time, and we're just going to sit. We're just going to be here. Because that's what Israel was going to have happen to them. It's not exactly a divorce, but it's not a fruitful marriage either. They're living many days in exile. They're living many days without a king. There's no ruler in place. There's no David present. They don't have the religious systems built up. They're not worshiping Yahweh, and Yahweh's not really blessing them either. No ephod, no teraphim. The priestly system is destroyed. It's not working. Nothing works. But it's also not forgotten. You know, gone but not forgotten is kind of the idea. And at the end of that time, there will be restoration. At the end of that time, there will be a Messiah. At the end of that time, the ruler from David will come back. He will reinstate the kingly line. He will reinstate sacrifices and true worship. He will reinstate. He will actually be this greater priest. He will restore it all, and it will be bigger and better than ever before. And in that day, once that occurs, then the children of Israel will return, and they will seek the Lord their God, and they will seek David their king. This messianic promise, right? They're going to fear the Lord and his goodness in the last days. So that sort of ends the first three chapters are really the family life of Hosea, and that's his functional prophecies as it relates to Gomer and his children. The first chapter being primarily about the children, the second chapter being primarily about his wife, and then the restoration of the two at the end. So we'll open it up the last few minutes. Thoughts, questions, things that have been encouraging to you even throughout all three of these chapters. Yeah. Yeah, that's why it's a sharp. That's why it's a surprising end to the divorce hearing. Because the only thing he's brought before are charges. Their mother's played the harlot. She behaved shamefully. I'll go after other lovers. I don't think we're supposed to say that verse 7 is the prerequisite of the therefore. You know, that she says, okay, I will return. I'll go back. And he says, okay, well then therefore I'll do this. It seems like it's all prerequisite on his character, on what's right. It would be very, it's good and right for him to hedge her way with thorns. It's good and right for him to come and take everything that is his. And it's also good and right for him to be generous and kind. All three are appropriate responses. The last one's not. Mm-hmm. I think that's where verses 19 and 20 of chapter 2 are so impactful, that this entire covenant is based eternally, not upon her activity, but upon his characteristics. Right? Loving kindness, justice, or righteousness, justice, loving kindness, mercy, faithfulness. That's what the eternal covenant's based in. It's gone so far that Hosea's not even in her mind. She's run from it. And I think that 3:5, I think, is the parallel to 7b. That's the return, going back after repentance, going back after their first husband. But that the goodness isn't even prerequisite on their activity in chapter 2. You know, I think we could probably say that chapter 1, verse 10, that the Abrahamic promise, Abrahamic covenant, is part of what's prerequisite to this, and the Davidic covenant also being mentioned, like both of those are like, that's the promise ultimately that God's keeping, as we know. So neither of those covenants depended upon the faithfulness of the mother, the faithfulness of the wife.